Over the past few years, Sarah Palin has been at the center of many political controversies, but her latest brouhaha was over her use of language when, on July 18th, she tweeted, "Ground Zero mosque supporters, doesn't it stab you in the heart as it does ours throughout the heartland? Peaceful Muslims, please repudiate." Here today to talk about repudiate, in other words, that people have invented, is Ben Zimmer, who writes the on-language column for the New York Times Magazine. Welcome to our show.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
Actually, Sarah Palin first used repudiate on Fox News on July 14th, but it didn't get much attention until she used it again the 4 days later on her on Twitter. I guess, does that mean more people are reading her tweets than are watching her on Fox?
That could be. Also, if she just used it on television as she did, people might have heard it and thought, wait, did she say refudiate or repudiate? It might have gone by very quickly. And it does sound very similar. So, you know, people might not have picked up on it so much. But when it's there in print on Twitter, then it's not only can we see that she really did mean refudiate, but it's also right there ready in a little packet for people to circulate. And that's what happens these days with Twitter, Facebook, other social media. Something like that will be picked up on, just a little bit of text like that. And before you know it, millions of people are talking about it.
Well, it's obviously not a mistake if you keep on using it. But beyond the use of the word refudiate, do you have any idea what that tweet means?
I won't get into the political specifics of it.
I'm thinking about all of that typing to go, doesn't it stab you in the heart as it does ours throughout the heartland? Peaceful Muslims, please refudiate. I guess she's saying that the mosque shouldn't be built and peaceful Muslims should enter into the dialogue?
That seems to be what she was saying. With Sarah Palin, sometimes it's a little unclear, especially in this very compact, haiku-like form of a tweet on Twitter. And so she was trying to fit in perhaps a large nebulous concept into 140 characters. And that does seem to be what she meant. She was calling on peace-loving Muslims to repudiate, we could say, to disavow this idea that there should be a mosque near the 9/11 site.
As she pointed out later, people have been inventing new words and adding them to the lexicon since Shakespeare, which got her called Shakespalin and the Bard of Wasilla.
That's right. Well, it's interesting. First, what happened, somebody must have brought this to her attention because the original tweet with refudiate was actually deleted and replaced by one with refute. In fact, repudiate probably would have been better in that case because it's closer to what her meaning was, I think. So it seems that even Palin or her handlers realized that this was a mistake. But then the genie was already out of the bottle at that point. So they decided to embrace it, and they put out this she put out this follow-up tweet in which she related herself to the current and former president by bringing up Misunderestimate, the classic Bushism from George W. Bush, wee-weed up, which was a peculiar word that Obama used last year. And then she said, yeah, Shakespeare liked to coin new words too. So just by putting herself in the same class as Shakespeare, she probably realized she was going to stir things up. And sure enough, everybody was talking about it and tweeting about it and coming up with variations. And it became this internet meme that got all over the place, traveling virally.
My guest is Ben Zimmer, who writes the on-language column for the New York Times Magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. As you pointed out in a recent column, if refudiate makes it into the language, it wouldn't be the first time that a slip-up from a public figure gets enshrined into the lexicon. And you mentioned misunderestimated. But are those Bushisms used, or do we simply associate them with the kind of malaprops that father and son Bush often were to utter?
Well, something can start off as a malapropism and be recognized as that, and then eventually get into wider circulation. And with some of these Bushisms, including misunderestimate, it is very much still associated with George W. Bush, but it has been embraced. In fact, there was a sympathetic book written about George W. Bush, and the title of it was Misunderestimated. George W. Bush himself self-effacingly talked about these Bushisms, and so you know he recognized this as well. But there were other things that Bush said which got picked up sometimes rather sarcastically. So, for instance, rather famously in a debate in 2004, he referred to the internet as the internets, plural. And people picked up on that right away. This is even before Twitter and so forth, but on blogs and so forth, people started picking up on that and talking about the internets in this sarcastic reference to George W. Bush. And you might also remember Senator Ted Stevens referring to the internet as a series of tubes in 2006. And so that kind of funny reference or metaphor for the internet got picked up as well sarcastically. And in fact, people sometimes joined these two things together. They joined the internets and the tubes together and started talking about the intertubes. So it's just the way that people have fun with it, have fun with the way that public figures speak.
And when Will Ferrell did his Bush impression on Saturday Night Live, he coined the words strategery. I'm sorry. Yes, as I guess strategic and
right. Well, it's just sort of making a noun form out of strategic, or which didn't previously exist. So yeah, in the Saturday Night Live sketch, it was a debate between Bush and Gore, and they were asked what their favorite word was, and that's what Will Ferrell as Bush said, strategery, and that was brilliant because it really picked up on. The way that Bush used language and how, you know, Bush himself sort of would self-effacingly realize this. And in fact, that term strategery was also kind of became an in-joke in the Bush White House, apparently. I think we learned from the Scooter Libby trial that there were apparently strategery meetings. They themselves had picked up on that word, just recognizing the humor of it.
Well, politicians have often used words that struck people in an odd way. Joe Klein pointed out in a recent post that Warren G. Harding used the words normalcy instead of normality and bloviating, but did he invent those words?
He didn't. I think that Warren Harding has gotten a bad rap. I mean, everybody I think recognized that he wasn't the greatest public speaker. What people remember are these two words, and neither of them were his own inventions or errors. Normalcy, which was part of his campaign slogan. Return to normalcy after the uproar, the tumult of World War I. That term normalcy had actually been kicking around since the mid-19th century. It wasn't as common as the other noun form normality, but people had used it. And so he brought it into wider circulation by using it in a campaign slogan. And it's hard to say that that is wrong because, again, it had been used just as another type of noun that you could create from the word normal. As for bloviate, that also had been around for a while since the mid-19th century, and it was kind of a funny word, and people recognized it as a funny word. It was sort of pseudo-Latin. You take the word blow, which could mean to boast, as in a blowhard, and you make a funny Latin-sounding verb out of it, bloviate, or talk about bloviation. And so Harding himself recognized he wasn't a great speaker, and he said he had a tendency to bloviate, again, kind of making fun of himself. But actually, that word bloviate is part of this great American tradition of making funny-sounding words. In the mid-19th century, that was often words that were created to sound sort of like Latin. So another great one is absquatulate, which you'd sort of take the pieces of abscond and squat, and you create this word absquatulate to run away or to flee. And so it's part of that great tradition, I think. But people remember Harding for these two words, even though I think that we should give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt on those.
Well, bloviate is still in the lexicon, and it's a useful word, I think. Some other words, I remember when I started doing this show, many listeners were outraged by words like hopefully and curated. Nobody seems to complain anymore, but irregardless still seems to rub some people the wrong way.
Well, irregardless is a fascinating one because it's one of the great sort of bugaboos of English usage. Whenever I'm on a sort of a call-in show about people's pet peeves, very often irregardless will come up. Now, obviously, there's something wrong about that because it's kind of like a two negatives there. You just should say regardless instead of irregardless. And it seems like it might be mashing up or blending two words, irrespective and regardless, into this word that, sort of like misunderestimated, it's a bit too much. It adds this extra negative to it where it doesn't really belong. But in fact, recent research has shown that sort of mistaken formation, irregardless, has a very long history. People had been thinking of it basically as a 20th century phenomenon. But now that we have access to newspaper databases, we can actually trace irregardless all the way back to 1795. There was a poem that appeared in the City Gazette of Charleston, South Carolina, that used the word, and it certainly fit the poem in how it's scanned. But it's a lot older than people realize. And in fact, there were other words.
I wonder if the paper got letters, outraged letters.
I don't think so. I mean,
because I get outrage mail all the time when guests misuse a word. I never misuse a word, but but guests often do, and people are just so angry.
It's true. There's a lot of rage about some of these usage issues, but the view about irregardless, I think people would not have worried so much about it back then, because actually there were other words that seemed to like double up these negatives when they really didn't need them. Back in the 17th, 18th century, there were words like undoubtless or unhelpless. So it probably fit with those types of words. But nowadays we hear it and we say that's just wrong and it really bothers people.
On the other hand, there are these slang words that are invented. They may have short lives, but they become very popular, like chillax.
Chillax, yeah.
Ginormous.
Ginormous, right, yeah. Well, chillax is a new one. Ginormous is a little older. Chillax has only been around since the mid-90s, as far as we know, and it combines chill and relax in a very slangy way. So that one has gotten popular. Ginormous, it might feel kind of new, but in fact, we know that it goes all the way back to World War II, first showing up in the slang of the British armed forces, like the RAF. There are examples of that going back to the 40s. It was obviously just a kind of a joke word combining giant and enormous. It doesn't necessarily add anything to those two words, but it's sort of a funny sounding word that starts off facetiously and sometimes can actually work its way pretty seriously into the language.
Sometimes people make up words for comic effect that actually could be quite useful, Stephen Colbert's truthiness, for example. But can anybody say that other than Stephen Colbert?
Well, that was 5 years ago that Stephen Colbert first uttered that word, truthiness, on the premiere episode of The Colbert Report. And people do talk about truthiness now, and very often there's at least the implicit reference there. There's an allusion going on to Colbert and the way he used it. It hasn't completely broken free and become something that's sort of freestanding because it has those associations. But it was recently announced by the new Oxford American Dictionary that their new edition to be published this year will include the word truthiness in the Colbert sense.
What about the Simpsons words like cromulent and ambiguous?
Yeah, well, those are great examples because those were sort of consciously created as being fake words. So there was an episode in The Simpsons where the word ambiguous appeared as part of the town motto, and one character asked the other, "Ambiguous? I've never heard that word before." And the other character says, "Oh, I think it's a perfectly cromulent word." So ambiguous, we know, means make bigger, but we don't really know what cromulent means other than it's something good.
My guest is Ben Zimmer, who writes the On Language column for the New York Times Magazine, picking up where William Sapphire left off. We will be taking some of your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. People have already been writing in. And by the way, you can also find a link to Ben Zimmer's latest article on our show page at WNYC.org. We'll be back right after this. We're back with Ben Zimmer, who writes the On Language column for the New York Times Magazine. And we're inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave comments on our show page at WNYC.org. Before we get to them, what about the celebrity blends like Brangelina and Bennifer, the couplings of the names of the two people involved? Is this something that's a fairly recent phenomenon?
It is fairly recent, yes. We had sort of a whole flurry of them, Benifer, Brangelina, Tomcat. There were a whole bunch of them that started popping up. The whole idea of combining two people's names to create this kind of hybrid beast, I mean, there are examples of that going back a ways. And even in politics, too, you might remember Bill and Hillary Clinton being referred to as Billary. In terms of the entertainment industry, the earliest example I was able to find was way back in the silent movie era when Greta Garbo and John Gilbert were a couple, one of the first real sort of celebrity couples of Hollywood. And so their names were blended together into Gilbo Garbage, just sort of a funny combination of their two names. So in that respect, it's not entirely new, but certainly we had this this big efflorescence of these celebrity blends, starting, I believe, with Benifer being the first in that group.
Some newly coined words like locavore don't get complaints because they're just because they're so useful.
Well, locavore, referring to someone who tries to eat only locally grown products, is a very recent invention, and so recent we know exactly when and where it was coined, just in, I believe, 2006 in the Bay Area by a local food group that was trying to get people to eat only food raised within a 100-mile radius of San Francisco. That's the type of thing where people sort of recognize, okay, this is a new word describing a new social phenomenon. We need a word for it. And so something like that can take off. And actually, there were some complaints about locavore because it is this sort of unusual mashup. If you look at it in terms of Latin classical roots, it might not really be the best thing. If you were forming it from Latin, maybe you should say proxivore or something like that. But locavore caught on for local eating, using that vore ending for eating, and people really liked it, and it caught on very quickly.
And is that okay? We don't get complaints about that? Because almost everything new gets somebody complaining.
That's true. That's true. Pretty much people will look at any kind of coinage or neologism, and very often they'll say, "Well, I'm not used to that," and will try to find problems with it. And very often these words don't succeed. It's only the success stories that people start using that really draw the complaints, because people say, "Wait, why is everyone using this word, chillax or whatever?"
What about verbing nouns? Is this something that's only a recent development? While the Winter Olympics were going on, people used verbs like to podium, to medal, to summit. And I've also heard in that spirit to doorbell. I used to have a boss here who would tell people that we, during fundraisers, we made certain gifts available to incent them to become members, which incensed a few listeners.
the whole verbing of nouns, as it's been called, is actually a very old phenomenon in English, and it goes on all the time. And really, you mentioned podium and medal in the Olympics. Those were ones that people picked up on, probably because it's being used in this particular group, the Olympic athletes, and they only get exposed to that language when the Olympics are on. It's very often when it's associated with a particular group. Very often, for instance, management speak or the language of corporations. It's a kind of a jargon very often, and when people are exposed to that, that may very, very often involve changing nouns to verbs and that sort of thing.
It may incent them to misuse the language.
it's the type of thing, again, that happens all the time, but it seems to be the ones that people complain about. Sometimes what they're really complaining about is something more social or cultural, where they have a problem with the kind of obfuscation that might go on, for instance, in management speak.
We'll take some calls. Our first caller is Rich from Brooklyn. Hi. You have a word?
Yes, I have a word that might – thank you for taking my call. I have a word that might be useful in the political or maybe in the foreign policy realm. Pragmire, which would be a combination of pragmatic and quagmire.
Uh-huh. And that would describe what's happening in Afghanistan at the moment?
It could very easily, yeah, or any number.
Okay. Well, you like that word?
Sure, pragmire. That's a nice blend or portmanteau word. So combining pragmatic and quagmire, those seem like two things that might come up often in a political context where you get into a quagmire for pragmatic reasons. And one nice thing about an example like that is you can see where the two words join together. They share a sound. They share that ag sound. So that allows the two words to overlap in the same way that, you know, the other blends we were talking about, say, misunderestimate was misunderstand plus underestimate.
So proxy and a quagmire could be a proxmire, or that could be a senator, right?
That's true. There could be another variation on that.
Barbara from Nassau County. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My daughter was very excited recently because something good had happened to her, and she felt so exuberated.
Yeah, exuberated, right. So,
are we hearing that, or is that just her daughter's invention?
Well, I bet if you Googled for it, you could probably find other people using it. It's interesting, though, that children very often are the ones who are coming up with these clever combinations of words because they're soaking up language very quickly, and they're learning these long words, like they're learning exuberant and exhilarated. And very often we hear this from children who might just sort of creatively mash up words. They might not even realize how creative they're being. But it's part of the kind of natural impulse of what we do with language. We sort of take these building blocks and we mash them together and we find new combinations.
We have some others that have been written in. One listener says that she came up with ambisextrous.
Ambisextrous, yeah. I actually feel like I've seen that one somewhere before. So, yeah, taking ambidextrous, and that's another kind of blend where you're sort of plopping the word sex down into the middle of ambidextrous in order to create a new kind of mashup. But that one I feel like I've seen before on lists of, you know, creative blends like that. So, again, very often people will say, I came up with something new. But you very often will find, because we're all dealing with the same building blocks of language, there may be a lot of independent invention or reinvention going on all the time.
Another listener came up with some favorite words. Guesstimate, which has been rather useful.
Definitely, yeah.
Splendiferous,
mm-hmm.
These words have entered the language, haven't they?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, guesstimate is a good example of a word that that might have started off again as a kind of a playful combination of guess and estimate. But we hear that all the time now, and it's certainly in dictionaries as a noun, guesstimate, or as a verb, to guesstimate.
Martha asks about the word signage. Is that a made-up word?
Well, you know, we're using this expression, made-up word. All words are really made up on some level.
Shakespeare made up words, as Sarah Palin pointed out.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, every word was made up at some point. And so signage is, I think, a rather unremarkable example of just taking a sign and adding that ending. It serves its purpose to refer not just to any particular sign, but, you know, the whole, you know, all of these signs that one would see in a cityscape, for instance.
Well, a listener asked about verbiage versus verbiage. Do people say verbiage?
Some do. In fact, I'm trying to think. Sarah Palin might have even used that word.
The word verbiage?
I'm trying to remember. There was some public
figure
recently.
I think she's going to call in to refute that.
But verbiage or verbiage would generally be considered the more proper form, and verbiage would probably be considered a non-standard variant of that.
Now, Google informs one of my producers that exuberated is an archaic form of the word from the 15th century.
Well, you know, this very often happens where, again, you know, something may seem new. And again, in the example from the caller, that was just invented by a child. But then if you look at the historical record, you'll find that, for instance, a word like truthiness, Colbert was certainly not the first to come up with that. We've got that. It's actually in the Oxford English Dictionary from the 1820s. It not necessarily in the exact way that Colbert meant it, but this very often happens. Words, another one would be unfriend, which we now associate with Facebook to take someone off your friend list. That one goes back for centuries. So sometimes these words have a way of popping up again and rising up like Rip Van Winkle, or sometimes they've been called Sleeping Beauties. They get revivified.
Our next caller is Joanne from Hastings-on-Hudson. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you one of my son's first words was refuterator.
as the place where you find the food that's
yes,
been
right.
chilled.
Yes. Well, he didn't even care about chilled. He just wanted to eat, so he would point to the refrigerator.
Well, again, another great example of sort of the natural creativity that we find kids just playing with language. And with that one, I could understand actually how that one gets formed, because think about refrigerator. How do we shorten that? We shorten refrigerator to fridge. So that seems like the sort of the most important part of the word. You just swap it out with food, and you get refrigerator.
Thank you for calling us.
Okay.
Edward from Westfield, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
My 19-year-old niece and all her new intellectual awesomeness, if that's a word, corrected me on what you guys are doing now, conversate.
Now, another listener, Becky, wrote in to say she's really irked by that word, conversate.
Right. Well, that's an example of what linguists call a back formation. So you take the word conversation and you form a verb from it just by taking off the ION ending, and you end up with conversate, even though conversation itself was already formed from a perfectly good verb, converse. So the problem there is that, you know, we have this kind of needless formation coming back from the noun and creating conversate. So something like that is still sort of considered non-standard, but other back formations that enter the language, no problem. Sometimes they enter, but then might be acceptable in one dialect of English and not another dialect of English. A good example of that would be orientate, which bothers a lot of Americans who would just prefer the verb to be orient. But in British English, orientate is perfectly fine.
A listener points out that Maya Bloomberg, and he's not the only one who does this, tends to put S's on the ends of words that don't need them. Internets, he says, elsewheres, words like that. Is this a regionalism?
That could very well be a regionalism, yeah, yeah. I mean, we find
it's like saying height, and the people in Philadelphia will say the height and the width.
Right, right. Sometimes there will be differences of pronunciation like that. Adding an S to it, I mean, you could have something like the anyway versus anyways, mm-hmm. for instance, where the anyways form could be a regional form that is still considered not standard, but is used by a lot of people in speech generally, and also just casual, informal written English as well.
Of course, it reveals that he's not really a New Yorker.
That could actually be a little clue if we looked at all the little clues to find out, you know, what his native dialect is. Yeah.
Sean from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for accepting my call. I had a friend of mine. She and I yesterday had a chocolate à la maison, and she put up the word discombobulated.
Mm-hmm. That's a perfectly good word, isn't it?
I was thinking about disoriented. And we were going back and forth whether or not the word was real. I said, I'm not really quite sure. And she tried to send me a link to back up a word.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't quite sure.
Right. I mean, discombobulate. That we were talking about words that were sort of made up to be funny words. So so something like discombobulate is another example of that. When it was coined, it was one of those words like bloviate or absquatulate that sounds like fake Latin, basically. It's a funny way of like creating a word and making it sound important by having this kind of Latin sound to it when really it's describing something very kind of slangy. And one interesting variation on that, I believe it's in Milwaukee in the airport there, when you go through airport security and you have to, you know, take off your shoes and your belt and everything. When you get through that process and you have to put yourself back together again, they put up a sign that says recombobulation area.
And that's just limited to Milwaukee?
That's where it was spotted. Yeah, I don't know if other airports have picked up on that and have their own recombobulation areas now.
Well, there's a lot of beer brewed in Milwaukee. I don't know if that's any connection. Thank you so much for your call. Amy from Livingston, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air, and you have to make it quick.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to make a quick case for misunderestimated. I've never used it, but I thought to myself, perhaps it could mean I underestimated the person, but for the wrong reason. I thought he was really stupid, but actually I underestimated his intelligence. What do you think?
Do you think that's the way George Bush intended it to be interpreted?
I'm not going there.
You know, that's the thing. Things can start off where they could seem like a mistake or an erroneous combination of words. But then when you think about it, well, sure, why not? It could actually combine those two qualities. And in fact, the same argument has been made for Sarah Palin's use of repudiate. Why not have a new word that combines the qualities of repudiate, refute, perhaps refuse, and then you get this sort of new amalgamation of sound and sense.
Except, as you pointed out, repudiate would have been the better usage anyway. We want to thank you so much for being with us. Ben Zimmer writes the On Language column for the New York Times Magazine, and there's a link to that column on our show page at wnyc.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks. It's been fun.
I'm not going to make up a word to make a joke.